says, "Well, I guess there's a good reason the police didn't want us involved." Agnew grunts his agreement. Judith asks, "How can you prove any of this?" "I didn't say I could prove it. Proof will be difficult, if not impossible. There may be surveillance footage of Nancy at the truck stop, taking the kid in. But I bet she's disguised in some way. I doubt if Starcher could identify the guy who grabbed him at the park. I don't know. You have any suggestions?" She says, "It seems pretty far-fetched, the theory that the police would abduct a child." "So you don't believe me?" I fire back. The truth is that she wants to believe me. She wants my story to be true, because then she can use it as evidence against me when she drags me back to court. She won't answer my question. "So what's next?" I ask Beatty. "Wow, I'm not sure. We'll have a chat with our supervisor and go from there." I say, "I have a meeting this afternoon with an investigator with the police. They'll seem concerned, ask a lot of questions, but it's going nowhere. They'll close the case by the end of the week and be happy with a good outcome." Beatty asks, "And you want us to open an investigation?" I look at Judith and say, "Perhaps we should talk about it first. I'm inclined to pursue Kemp. What about you?" She says, "Let's talk." Beatty and Agnew take their cue and stand to leave. We thank them, and Judith walks them to the front door. When she returns to the conference room, she sits across from me and says, "I don't know what to do. I'm not thinking clearly right now." "We can't allow the police to do this, Judith." "I know, but don't you already have enough trouble with them? If Kemp is desperate enough to snatch a child, he might do anything. Now do you understand why I get nervous when Starcher is with you?" I can't really argue with this. "Do you think Swanger killed the girl?" she asks. "Yes, and he's probably killed others." "Great. Another lunatic out there gunning for you. You're a train wreck, Sebastian, and you're going to get someone hurt. I just hope it's not my child. We got lucky today, but maybe not tomorrow." There's a knock on the door, and Judith says, "Come in." The receptionist tells her there is a reporter with a cameraman out front. Two more have called the office. "Get rid of them," she says, glaring at me. What a mess I've created. We finally agree to do nothing for a few hours. I'll cancel the meeting with the police detective. The investigation is a sham anyway. As I leave, I tell her I'm sorry, but she wants no part of an apology. I sneak out a rear door. Chapter 7. Reporters are looking for me, but I have had enough of the story. Others would like to find me. Link and his boys. Roy Kemp when he hears I'm talking to the FBI. Perhaps even Arch Swanger, who's likely to phone in at any moment and ask why I sang to the police. Partner takes me to Ken's cars, and I drive away in a dented Mazda with 200,000 miles on it. No lawyer, regardless of how impoverished, would be caught dead in such a vehicle. I know one who was leasing a Maserati when he was forced into bankruptcy. I spend the rest of the day in my apartment, hiding and working on two cases. Around 5 o'clock, I call Judith to check on Starcher. "He's fine," she says, "and the reporters have gone away." I check the local news where the dramatic rescue is the lead story. They use some old footage of me walking into the police station and make it sound like I risked my life to save my son. The fools are swallowing all the bait the police give them. This, too, shall pass. Because I've slept about 6 hours out of the last 72, I finally collapse on the sofa and fall into a coma. Just after 10 p.m., my cell phone rings. I check the caller ID, then grab it. It's Naomi Tarrant, Starcher's teacher, the gorgeous young thing I've been fantasizing about for months. I've asked her to dinner 5 times and have been hit with 5 no's, but the rejections have been progressively softer. I have neither the talent nor the patience for the usual mating rituals, the stalking, the accidental encounters, the blind dates, the silly gifts, the awkward phone calls, the referrals from friends, the endless internet chatting. Nor do I have the guts to go online and lie about myself to strange women. And I fear I'm forever scorched and gun-shy from the Judith disaster. How can one human possess so much meanness? Naomi wants to talk about Starcher, so we do. I assure her he was not harmed in any way. He'll never understand what really happened, and I doubt anyone will tell him. Frankly, he was pampered for about 45 hours by two people he viewed as buddies. He'll be at school tomorrow, and he needs no special attention. I'm sure his mother will arrive with a long list of demands and concerns, but that's his mother. What a bitch, Naomi says, dropping her guard for the first time. I'm surprised by this, but love it nonetheless. We spend a few minutes thoroughly trashing Judith and Ava, who we agree is an airhead, and I haven't had this much fun in years. From left field, she says, "Let's do dinner." Ah, the life of a hero. The power of celebrity. The reporters claim I risked my neck to save my son, and women are throwing themselves at me. We establish a few rules. The date has to be a big secret. The school does not expressly forbid its unmarried teachers dating unmarried parents, but it's certainly frowned on. And why ask for trouble? If Judith found out, she would probably file a complaint or a lawsuit or something from her bottomless bag of dirty tricks. We meet in a dark, low-end Tex-Mex joint the following night. Her choice, not mine. Since no one speaks English, no one will be listening. No one cares, especially me. Naomi is 33 years old and rebounding from a divorce. No kids, no discernible baggage. She begins by telling me all about Starcher's day at school. As expected, Judith brought him early and had some instructions. All went well. No one mentioned his little ordeal. Naomi and her classroom aide kept a close eye on him, and, as far as they could tell, nothing was said by his friends. He seemed perfectly normal and went about the day as if nothing had happened. Judith picked him up after school and grilled Naomi, but it was hardly out of the ordinary. "How long were you married to her?" she asks in amazement. "The paperwork says less than 2 years, but we could live together for only the first 5 months. It was unbearable. I tried to tough it out until the kid was born, but then I found out she was already seeing her latest girlfriend. I fled, he was born, and we've been fighting ever since. Getting married was a horrible mistake, but she was pregnant. I've never seen her smile. I think it happens about once a month. The margaritas arrive in tall, salty mugs, and we dive in. We briefly touch on her marriage, then move on to more pleasant matters. She's been dating, there are lots of calls, and I can understand why. She has soft, beautiful brown eyes that are hypnotic, even seductive. The kind of eyes you can gaze into for hours and wonder if they're real. Me? I don't date much. Don't have the time, too much work, and so on. The usual disclaimers. She seems fascinated by my work, the unpopular cases, the notoriety, some of the thugs I represent. We order enchiladas and I keep chatting away. I soon realize, though, that she follows the one rule of a great conversationalist. Keep the other person talking. So I push back and ask about her family, college, other jobs she's had. I order a second margarita. She's half-finished with her first, and we go back and forth with stories about our past. A platter of enchiladas arrives, and she hardly notices. Judging by her figure, she has the appetite of a bird. I can't remember the last time I had sex, and the longer we talk, the more I am consumed with that subject. By the time I finish both the food and the booze, I'm fighting the urge to lunge across the table. But Naomi Tarrant is not impulsive. This will take time. It's Tuesday, so I ask her what she's doing Wednesday. No go. "You know what I'd really like?" she asks. "What? Anything?" "This may seem a bit odd, but I'm really curious about mixed martial arts."
"Cage fights?
You want to go to the cage fights?" I'm stunned.
"Is it safe?"
she asks, and mentions the little episode involving the riot and Starcher's close call with disaster. "Judith sued me again, and Naomi got a subpoena to testify." "If there's no brawl, it's pretty safe," I say. "Let's go." The truth is, at least half of the fanatics who show up at the fights and scream for blood are women. We book a date for this coming Friday. I'm thrilled because there is another young fighter I need to evaluate. His manager has contacted me and needs some financial backing. Chapter 8. Not surprisingly, Doug Renfro has not done well since his wife was murdered by one of our SWAT teams. The civil trial is 2 months away, and Doug is not looking forward to it. He's had his day in court, and he's not ready for another one. I meet him for lunch in an empty deli, and I'm startled by his appearance. He's lost a lot of weight, pounds that he needed. His face is gaunt and pale, and his eyes convey the pain and confusion of a defeated and lonely man. He nibbles on a chip and says, "I've put the house on the market. I can't stay there. Too many memories. I can see her in the kitchen. I can feel her sleeping in the bed next to me. I can hear her laughing on the phone. I can smell her body lotion. She's everywhere, Sebastian, and she's not going away. Worst of all, I can't help but relive those last few seconds, the gunfire and screams and the blood. I blame myself for so much of what went wrong. I often leave at midnight and go find a cheap motel where I pay $60 and stare at the ceiling until sunrise. I'm sorry, Doug," I say. "It certainly wasn't your fault." "I know. But I'm not rational. Plus, I hate this damned city. Every time I see a cop or fireman or a garbage worker, I start cursing the city and the fools who run it. I can no longer pay taxes to this government. So I'm out of here." "What about your family?" "I'll see them whenever I need to. They have their own lives to live. I gotta take care of me this time. And that means I need a new start somewhere."
"Where are you going?"
"It changes every day, but right now it looks like New Zealand. As far away as I can get. I'll probably renounce my citizenship, so I won't have to pay taxes here. I'm a bitter old man, Sebastian, and I have to get away."
"What about the civil trial?"
"I'm not going to trial. I want you to settle it as soon as you can. Hell, the city's liability is only $1 million. They'll pay that, won't they?"
"Yes, I assume. I haven't talked settlement with them, but they don't want to go to trial."
"Is there a way to get more than $1 million?
"Maybe." He slowly takes a sip of his tea and stares at me.
"How?" "I've got some dirt on the police department. Some crap that's pure filth. Extortion is what I'm thinking."
"I like it," he says with a smile. "The first and only."
"Can you move fast? I want to get out of here. I'm sick of this place."
"I'll see what I can do."
Chapter 9. When my cell phone buzzes after midnight, it's never a call I want to take. At 12:02, I pick it up and see that partner wants to talk.
"Hey, boss," he says in a weak voice. "They tried to kill me."
"Are you okay?"
"Not really. I've got some burns, but I'll be all right. I'm at the hospital, Catholic. We need to talk."
I strap a Glock 19 under my left armpit, put on a heavy coat and a brown fedora, and hustle down to the parking lot to retrieve my worn-out Mazda. 10 minutes later, I enter the ER wing of the hospital and say hello to one Juke Sadler, one of the sleaziest lawyers in town. Juke roams the city's emergency rooms, trolling for injured clients. Like a vulture, he loiters in the hallways watching for distraught relatives too panicked to think clearly.
He's been known to have lunch and dinner in hospital cafeterias while passing out cards to those with broken bones. Last year, he got in a fistfight with a tow truck driver who was hustling the family of a fresh car wreck victim. Both were arrested, but only Juke got his photo in the newspaper. The Bar Association has been after him for years, but he's too slick. "Your man's down the hall," he says, pointing like one of those retired hospital volunteers in pink jackets. They actually caught him once wearing that jacket and posing as a greeter. They also caught him wearing a white collar and black jacket and pretending to be a priest. Juke is an unrepentant slimeball. But I admire the guy. He operates in the dark, murky waters of the law, where we have much in common. Partner is in a gown, sitting on an exam table, his right arm covered in gauze. I take a look and say, "Okay, let's have it." He was leaving an all-night chicken carry-out restaurant with a snack for him and his mom. He got in the van, put it in reverse, and the damned thing blew up. A bomb, probably of the gasoline variety, probably stuck to the fuel tank and remotely detonated by someone sitting in a car nearby. Partner managed to scramble out and remembers hitting the pavement with his jacket on fire. He crawled away and watched the van turn into a fireball. Soon there were cops and firemen everywhere, a lot of excitement. He couldn't find his phone. A medic cut his jacket off and they loaded him into an ambulance. As they rolled him into the ER, someone handed him his phone.
"Sorry, boss," he says.
"Not exactly your fault. As you know, that van is heavily insured, for occasions just like this. We'll get a new one."
"I've been thinking about that," he says, grimacing.
"Oh, really?"
"Yeah, boss. Maybe we get something that's not quite so conspicuous, so easy to spot and follow. Know what I mean? Like, just the other day I was driving along the expressway and I got passed by a white cargo van owned by a flower delivery service. Standard white job, about the same size as ours. And I think to myself, that's the way to go. No one ever notices a white van with lettering and numbers painted on the sides. And it's true. We got to blend in, boss, not stand out in the crowd."
"And what exactly do we paint on the side of our new van?"
"I don't know. Something fictitious. Pete's Parcel, Fred's Flowers, Mike's Masonry. Doesn't really matter, just something to go with the flow."
I'm not sure my clients would appreciate a generic white van with a fake name painted all over it. My clients are very discerning. He laughs at this. The last client to step into my van was Arch Swanger, a likely serial killer. A young doctor suddenly appears and steps between us without a word. He examines the bandages and finally asks Partner how he feels.
"I want to go home," he says. "I'm not staying overnight."
This is fine with the doctor. He loads Partner down with bandages, gives him some samples of painkillers, and disappears. A nurse has the discharge instructions and paperwork. Partner puts on his unburned pants, socks, and shoes, and walks out with a cheap blanket wrapped around his upper body. We leave the hospital and drive to the fried chicken restaurant. It's almost 2 a.m., and a police cruiser is still parked near the crime scene. Strands of bright yellow tape surround the van, which is nothing but a smoldering blackened frame. "Stay here," I say to Partner, and get out of the car. By the time I walk 40 feet and stop at the yellow tape, a cop is coming toward me.
"That's far enough, pal," he says. "This is a crime scene."
"What happened?" I ask.
"Can't say. It's under investigation. You need to back away."
"I'm not touching anything."
"I said back away, okay?"
I pull a business card out of my shirt pocket and hand it to him. "I own the van, okay? It was a gasoline bomb stuck to the gas tank. Attempted murder. Please ask your investigator to call me later this morning." He looks at the card, but is unable to put together a response. I return to the car and sit in silence for a few minutes. "Want some chicken?" I finally ask.
"No. Not much of an appetite now."
I think I'd like some coffee. You?
Sure.
I get out of the car again and walk into the restaurant. There are no customers, the place is dead, and the obvious question is, why does a chicken place stay open 24/7? But that's a question for someone else. A black girl with steel in both nostrils is loitering by the cash register. Two coffees, please, I say. No cream. This pisses her off, but she starts moving anyway.
$2.40,
she says as she grabs a pot, one that probably hasn't been touched in hours. As she sets the two cups on the counter, I say, that van out there belongs to me.
Well, I guess you need a new van,
she retorts with a sassy smile. How clever. Looks like it. Did you see it blow up?
Nah, didn't see it, but I heard it.
And I'm betting that you or one of your co-workers ran outside with a cell phone and caught it all on video, right? She's nodding smugly.
Yes.
Did you give it to the police? A grin.
No. Don't do nothing to help no police.
I'll give you $100 if you'll email me the video, and I won't tell a soul. She whips her phone out of her jeans pocket and says,
Give me your address and the cash.
We do the deal. On the way out, I ask, Any surveillance cameras outside?
Nah, police already asked about that. Man who owns this place is too cheap.
In the car, partner and I stare at my cell phone and watch the video, which is nothing more than the fireball he's already described. At least two fire trucks answered the call, and it took a while to douse the flames. The video runs for 14 minutes, and while entertaining, because it is my van, it reveals nothing useful. When the screen goes blank, partner asks,
Okay, who did it?
I reply, I'm sure it's Link. We punched out two of his thugs on Monday. Tit for tat. We're playing hardball now.
You think Link's in the country?
I doubt it. That would be too risky. I'll bet he's close by, though. Mexico or the Caribbean. Someplace just out of reach, but someplace that's easy to get to and from. I start the engine and we drive away. I'm impressed with how much partner has talked tonight. The excitement of getting blown up has loosened his tongue. I can tell he's in pain, but he would never admit it.
You got a plan? He asks.
Yes. I want you to find Miguel Zapata, Tadeo's brother. Now that the promising MMA career is over, I'm sure Miguel is devoting all his time to peddling drugs. I want you to explain to Miguel that I need some protection, that I'm representing his little brother on a murder rap for free, completely pro bono, because I love the kid and he can't afford to pay me, and that I'm getting squeezed by some thugs who work for Link Scanlon. Fango is one, though I've never known his real name.
They call him Tubby Fango, but his real name is Danny.
Impressive. Who's the other one, the one you plunked with your little baton?
Goes by Razor Rubilio. Real name is Arthur.
Tubby and Razor, I say, shaking my head. When did you take care of this bit of research?
After the altercation on Monday, I decided to snoop a little. Wasn't that hard, really.
Nice work. So give the names to Miguel and tell him that he needs to contact these boys and tell them to back off. Miguel and his boys are running coke, something Link had control of 30 years ago. It's unlikely Tubby and Razor have crossed paths with Miguel, but you never know. There are always strange connections down in the sewers. Please make it clear to Miguel that I don't want anyone hurt. Just some intimidation. Got it?
Got it, boss.
We're in the projects. The streets are dark and empty. However, if I stepped out of my car at this moment and showed my white face, I would immediately attract some unpleasant types. I made that mistake once before, but thankfully I had partner with me. I pull to the curb outside his building and say, I assume Miss Luella is waiting. He nods and says,
I called her, told her it was just a scratch. She'll be all right.
You want me to come in?
No, boss. It's pushing 3. Go get some sleep.
Call me if you need anything.
You got it, boss. Are we shopping for a new van tomorrow?
Not yet. I have to deal with the cops and my insurance company. I need some wheels. Mind if I start looking online?
Go right ahead, and take care.
You got it, boss.
Chapter 10. Since I cannot at this moment stand the thought of being in her presence, and she certainly prefers to avoid looking at me, Judith and I decide to hash things out over the phone. We begin somewhat pleasantly with the latest update on our son. He's doing well, no damage, no desire to really talk about last weekend. With that out of the way, we get down to business. Judith has decided that she does not want to pursue an FBI investigation into Roy Kemp and the kidnapping. She has her reasons, and they are solid. Life is good. Starcher is fine. If Kemp and company are desperate enough to snatch a kid in return for information, then who knows what else they might do. Let's leave them alone. Besides, proving Kemp was involved seems impossible. Can we really trust the FBI to go after a high-ranking law enforcement official? Plus, her trial calendar is packed. She doesn't want the distraction. Why should we complicate our already stressful lives? Judith is a fighter, a tough gal who backs down from nothing. She's also a conniving tactician who avoids the dangers of unintended consequences. If we push an investigation into Kemp, we have no idea what might happen next. And since we're dealing with a tough guy who's not thinking clearly, it's smart to assume retaliation is likely. To her surprise, I do not argue. We reach an agreement, a rare occurrence in our relationship. Chapter 11. Our mayor is a three-term guy with the imposing name of L. Woodrow Sullivan III. To the public and the voters, he's simply Woody, a smiling, back-slapping, friendly sort who'll promise anything for a vote. In private, though, he's an abrasive, sour prick who drinks too much and is fed up with his job. He can't walk away, though, because he has no place to go. He's up for re-election next year, and it appears as though he has no friends. Right now, his approval rating is around 15%, low enough to force any proud politician to quit in disgrace. But Woody's fought back before. He'd rather do anything than suffer through the meeting we're about to have. The third man in the room is the city attorney, Moss Corgan, a classmate of mine in law school. We despised each other back then, and things have not improved. He edited the law review and was headed for a gilded career in a fancy corporate law firm, one that imploded and left him scrambling for lesser work. Woody and Moss. Sounds like an ad for hunting gear. We meet in the mayor's office, a splendid room on the top floor of City Hall, with tall windows and views in three directions. A secretary pours coffee from an old silver pot as we take our places around a small conference table in one corner. We struggle through the obligatory chit-chat and make ourselves smile and act relaxed. Through discovery in the civil trial, I have let it be known that I intend to subpoena both of these guys to the witness stand. This fact hangs over the table like a dark cloud and makes professional politeness almost impossible. Woody brusquely says, "We're here to talk about a settlement, right?" "Yes," I say, and remove some papers from my briefcase. "I have a proposal, one that is rather lengthy. My client, Doug Renfro, prefers to settle all claims and get on with his life, what's left of it."
"I'm listening," Woody says rudely.
"Thank you. First, the 8 city cops who murdered Kitty Renfro must be fired. They have been on administrative leave since the murder and—"
"Do you have to use the word murder?" Woody interrupts.
"They haven't been convicted of anything," Moss adds.
"We're not in a courtroom, okay? And if I want to use the word murder, then I'll use it. Frankly, there is no other word in the English language adequate enough to describe what your SWAT boys did. It was murder. It's embarrassing that these thugs have not been terminated and that they're still getting their full salaries. They have to go. That's number one. Number two, the chief has to go with them. He's an incompetent jerk who should not have been hired in the first place. He oversees a corrupt department, he's an idiot, and if you don't believe me, then ask your voters. According to the last poll, at least 80% of the people in this city want him fired. They nod gravely but cannot make eye contact. Everything I've said has been said on the front page of the Chronicle. The city council passed a no-confidence vote by 3-1 against the chief, but the mayor won't fire him. The reasons are simple and complicated. If the 8 warrior cops and their chief are terminated before the civil trial, they would likely become hostile witnesses against the city. It's best if they remain united in their defense against the Renfro lawsuit. I continue. Once the lawsuit is settled, you can finally terminate them, right? Moss says,
Need I remind you that our liability is capped at $1 million?
No, you need not. I'm very aware of that. We'll take the million as a settlement, and you immediately fire the 8 cops and the chief.
Deal!
Woody practically yells across the table as he slaps it with a palm.
Deal! What else do you want?
Even though the city is on the hook for a measly $1 million, these guys are terrified of another trial. During the first one, I exposed in dramatic detail the gross malfeasance of our police department, and the Chronicle broadcast it on the front page for a week. The mayor, the police chief, the city attorney, and the council members were in bunkers. The last thing they want is another high-profile trial in which I humiliate the city.
Oh, I want a lot more, Mayor, I say.
Both look at me with blank faces. Slowly, fear begins to form in their eyes. I'm sure you remember the story of my little boy getting kidnapped last Saturday. Pretty frightening stuff, but a good ending and all that happy horseshit. What you don't know is that he was kidnapped by members of your police department. Woody's tough guy facade melts as his face droops and turns pale. Moss, a former Marine, is proud of his perfect posture, but right now he can't keep his shoulders from sagging. He exhales as the mayor sticks a fingernail between his teeth. Their eyes meet briefly. Identical looks of terror. With a bit of drama, I drop a document on the table, just out of their reach. I say, This is a 10-page affidavit signed by me, in which I describe, under oath, the kidnapping and abduction orchestrated by Assistant Chief of Police Roy Kemp in an effort to coerce me to divulge the location of his missing daughter's body. Arch Swanger was never my client, contrary to what you've read and what you believe, but he did tell me where the body was supposedly buried. When I refused to pass along this information to the cops, my son was kidnapped. I caved, told Detective Reardon what I knew, and a full-scale dig took place at the location last Sunday night. They found nothing. The body was not there. Kemp then released my son. Now he wants me to forget all about it. But that's not going to happen. I'm working with the FBI. You think you have problems with the Renfro case? Just wait until the city finds out how rotten your police department really is.
Can you prove this? Moss says with a dry throat.
I tap the affidavit and reply, It's all right here. There is surveillance footage from the truck stop where I found my son. He has been able to identify one of his abductors, a cop. The FBI is hot on the trail and chasing leads. This is not entirely true, of course, but how could they know? As in any war, the truth is the first casualty. I remove another document from my briefcase and place it next to the affidavit. And this is a rough draft of a lawsuit I plan to file against the city for the kidnapping. Kemp, as you know, is on administrative leave, still on your payroll, still an employee. I'll sue him, the department, and the city for a crime that will be front page from coast to coast.
You want Kemp fired too? Moss asks.
I don't care if Kemp stays or goes. He's a decent chap and a good cop. He's also a desperate father who's going through hell. I can give him a break.
Mighty nice of you, Woody mumbles.
What's this got to do with the settlement? Moss asks.
Everything. I'll bury the lawsuit and forget about it, get on with my life, and keep a closer eye on my kid. But I want another $1 million for Renfro. The mayor rubs his eyes with his knuckles as Moss sags even lower. They are overwhelmed and for one long minute cannot piece together enough words to respond. Finally, Woody mumbles a rather pathetic,
"Holy shit."
"This is extortion," Moss says. "It certainly is. But right now, extortion is a few notches down the pole. At the top is murder, followed by kidnapping. You don't want to start a pissing contest with me."
The mayor manages to stiffen his spine and say,
"And how are we supposed to find another $1 million to pass along to you and Mr. Renfrow without someone leaking it to the press?"
"Oh, you've moved money around before, Mayor. You've been caught a couple of times, got embarrassed with the scandals. But you know the game.
I did nothing wrong.
I'm not a reporter, so knock it off. Your budget this year is $600 million. You have rainy day funds, discretionary funds, slush funds, reserves for this and for that. You can figure it out.
The best route may be to deal with the city council in executive session, pass a resolution to reach a confidential settlement with Renfrow, and handle the money offshore." Woody laughs, but not because of anything humorous.
"So you think we can trust the city council to keep this quiet?"
"That's your problem, not mine. My job is to get a fair settlement for my client. $2 million is not fair, but we'll take it."
Moss gets to his feet, looking dizzy. He paces to a window and stares out at nothing. He stretches his back and paces around the room. Woody seems to grasp the reality that the sky is falling and asks,
"Okay, Rudd, how much time do we have?"
"Not much," I reply.
Moss says,
"We need some time to investigate this, Sebastian. You come in here, drop a bomb like this, and expect us to believe everything. There are a lot of moving parts here."
"Indeed, but an investigation will only cause leaks. And where will it take you? You're going to call in Kemp and ask him if he kidnapped my son? Gee, I wonder what he'll say. You can dig for months looking for the truth, and you won't find it. And I'm not in the mood to wait."
I slide the affidavit and the lawsuit across the table in Woody's direction. I stand and grab my briefcase. "Here's the deal. Today is Friday. You have the weekend. I'll be here at 10 Monday morning to wrap things up. If you boys can't figure it out, I go straight to the Chronicle with that little pile of papers. Imagine the story, the damage. Headlines on cable around the clock."
Woody is pale again. He says lamely,
"I'm in Washington Monday."
"Then cancel. Get a bad case of the flu. 10 Monday, gentlemen," I say as I open the door.
Chapter 12. Naomi is not too impressed with my rented Mazda. As we make our way downtown toward the auditorium, I explain what happened to my other vehicle. She is shocked that there are bad guys loose in the city who would attach an explosive device to my van to intimidate me and kill partner. She wants to know how soon the police will catch these guys and bring them to justice. She doesn't understand when I explain that, one, the police have no real interest in catching them because I am who I am, and two, the police can't catch them because these guys don't leave behind clues. She asks if she's safe in my company. When I tell her I have a gun strapped to my torso and wedged just under my left armpit, she takes a deep breath and gazes out the window. "Sure, we're safe," I promise her. In an effort at full disclosure, I tell her about my last office and the firebombing. No, the police have not solved that crime either, primarily because they were probably involved in the act. Either them or some drug dealers.
"No wonder you struggle with women," she observes.
And she's right. Most of them get spooked early in the game and gravitate towards safer men. Naomi, though, has a gleam in her eye and seems to enjoy the threat of danger. After all, the cage fights were her idea. I've pulled strings and our seats are ringside, third row back. I buy 2 tall beers and we settle in to watch the crowd. Unlike the theater or cinema, or the opera or symphony, or even a basketball game, the fans arrive in a rowdy mood, many of them already half drunk. It's another nice crowd, probably 3,000 to 4,000, and I marvel at the speed with which the sport has gained popularity. I also think of Tadeo, a talented kid now sitting in jail when he should be at the top of tonight's card. His trial is just around the corner, and he still expects me to pull a miracle and walk him out, a free man. For Naomi, I recount, in great graphic detail, the night not too long ago when Tadeo attacked the referee and this entire place turned into a riot. Starcher thought it was cool and wants to return for more fun. She thinks that's a bad idea. A trainer recognizes me and stops by for a chat. His kid is a 150-pounder who fights in the second match and has not lost in his last six. As he talks, he can't keep his eyes off Naomi. Because she's a knockout and dressed fashionably, she's getting plenty of looks. The trainer thinks his kid has a future and they need some backing. Since I'm viewed as a big-shot lawyer with plenty of cash, at least in this world, I'm a player who can make a career. I tell the guy we can talk later. Let me watch the kid for a couple of fights and then we'll meet. The trainer asks about Tadeo and shakes his head sadly. What a waste. When the place is packed, the lights go down and the crowd becomes frantic. The first two fighters enter the cage and introductions are made.
You know these guys?
Naomi asks excitedly.
Yes, just a couple of brawlers. Not much talent. Street fighters, really.
The bell sounds, the brawl is on, and my hot little schoolteacher sits on the edge of her seat and starts yelling. Chapter 13. At midnight, we're in a pizza dive, tucked into a narrow booth and sitting very close together. There has been some touching and hand-holding, and there seems to be a mutual attraction. I certainly hope it's mutual. She nibbles on a slice of pepperoni and prattles on about the main event, a heavyweight bloodfest that ended with a vicious chokehold. The loser stayed on the mat for a long time. Eventually, she gets around to the kidnapping and wants to know how much I know. I explain that the FBI is digging and I can't say anything. Was there a ransom demand? I can't say. A suspect? Not that I know of. What was he doing at that truck stop? Eating ice cream. I'd like to give her the details, but it's too early. Maybe later, when everything is settled. As we drive back to her place, she says, "It might be difficult to have a relationship as long as you're wearing a gun." "Okay, I can lose it. But it will always be close by."
"I'm not sure I like that."
Nothing else is said until I park outside her condo.
"I had a great time," she says.
"So did I." I walk her to the door of her condo and ask, "So, when can I see you again?" She pecks me on the cheek and says,
"7 tomorrow night. Right here. There's a movie I want to see."
Chapter 14. Partner picks me up in another rental, a shiny new U-Haul cargo van with $19.95 a day, unlimited mileage, splashed on both sides in bright green and orange paint. I look at it for a minute or so before finally getting in. "Nice," I say.
"I thought you'd like it," he says, grinning.
His bandages are hidden under his clothing. There's no evidence of his wounds. He's too tough to admit soreness or pain.
"I guess we'd better get used to it," I say.
"The insurance company is dragging its feet. Plus, it'll take a month to get a new one customized." We're moving through downtown traffic, just a couple of delivery boys with a van full of furniture. He stops in front of City Hall and parks illegally. A U-Haul van with such vivid colors is bound to attract a swarm of traffic cops.
"I chatted with Miguel," he says.
"And how did that go?" I ask, my hand on the door handle.
"Okay. I just explained things, said you were getting squeezed by some tough guys and needed a little protection. He said he could take care of it. Said it was the least he and the guys could do for you, and all that happy crap. I emphasized that no one gets hurt. Just a friendly hello to Tubby and Razor, so they'd get the message."
"What do you think?"
"It'll probably work. Link's gang is pretty thin these days, for obvious reasons. Most of his muscle is gone. I doubt if his boys want to mix it up with a drug gang."
"We'll see. Back in 30 minutes, I say as I get out. Woody canceled his trip to Washington and is waiting in his office with Moss. Both look as though they've had a bad weekend. It's Monday, and my goal is to ruin the rest of their week. There are no handshakes, no forced pleasantries, not even the offer of coffee. I jack up the tension with, "Okay, boys, do we have a deal? Yes or no? I want an answer now, and if I get the wrong answer, I'll leave this building and walk down the street to the Chronicle. Verdoliak, your favorite reporter, is waiting at his desk." Woody stares at the floor and says,
"Deal."
Moss slides across a document and says,
"This is a confidential settlement agreement. The insurance company will pay the first million now. The city will kick in $500,000 this fiscal year, same for next. We have a litigation reserve fund we can manipulate, but we need to split the two payments between this year and next. It's the best we can do."
"That'll work," I say. "And when will the chief and the SWAT boys get the axe?"
"Tomorrow morning," Moss says. "And that's not in this agreement."
"Then I won't sign the agreement until they are terminated."
"Why wait? What is so difficult about getting rid of these guys? Hell, the whole city wants them canned."
"So do we," the mayor says. "Believe me, we want them out of the picture. Just trust us on this, Rudd."
I roll my eyes at the word trust. I pick up the agreement and read it slowly. A phone buzzes on the mayor's imposing desk, but he ignores it. When I finish reading, I drop it on the table and say,
"Not one word of apology. My client's wife is murdered. He gets shot. Then he gets dragged through a criminal trial, faces prison, goes through hell and back, and not one word of apology. No deal."
Woody utters a bitter, "Shit," and jumps to his feet. Moss rubs his eyes as if he might start crying. Seconds pass, then a full minute, with nothing said. Finally, I glare at the mayor and say,
"Why can't you man up and do what's right? Why can't you call one of your press conferences, just like you do for every other minor crisis, and start with an apology to the Renfro family? Announce a settlement in the civil case. Explain that after a thorough investigation, it's now clear that the SWAT team disregarded all rules of procedure and safety, and that the eight cops are being terminated immediately, and their boss goes with them."
"I don't really need your advice when it comes to doing my job," Woody says, but it's a lame response.
"Maybe you do," I say.
I'm tempted to storm out again, but I don't want to lose the money.
"Okay, okay," Moss says. "We'll redraft it and throw in some language addressing the family."
"Thank you,"
I say. "I'll be back tomorrow, after the press conference." Chapter 15. I meet Doug Renfro for lunch in a coffee shop near his home. I explain the settlement, and he is thrilled to be getting $2 million. My contracted fee is 25%, but I'll cut it to only 10%. He is surprised by this and, at first, wants to argue. I'd like to give him all the money, but I do have some overhead. After I split with Harry and Harry, I'll net around $120,000, which is low for the time I've spent on the case, but still a decent fee. As he takes a sip of coffee, his hand starts shaking and his eyes suddenly water. He sets the cup down and pinches the bridge of his nose.
"I just want Kitty," he says, lips quivering.
"I'm sorry, Doug," I say.
"What else?" "Why did they do it? Why? It was so senseless. Kicking in the doors, guns blazing like idiots, the wrong house. Why, Sebastian?"
All I can do is shake my head.
"I'm out of here. I'll tell you that right now. Gone. I hate this city and the clowns who run it. And I gotta tell you, Sebastian, with these eight cops now out of work and pissed off and looking for trouble, I don't feel safe. You shouldn't either, you know?"
"I know, Doug. Believe me, I think about it all the time. But then I've pissed them off before. I'm not one of their favorites."
"You're a hell of a lawyer, Sebastian. I had my doubts at first. The way you came on so strong while I was still in the hospital, I kept thinking, who is this guy? I had other lawyers try and hustle the case, you know.
Some real clowns poking around the hospital. But I ran them off. Glad I did. You were great at trial, Sebastian. Magnificent.
Okay, okay, thanks, Doug, but that's enough.
15%, okay? I want you to take 15%. Please.
If you insist.
I do.
My house sold yesterday, nice profit.
We'll close in 2 weeks.
I think I'm going to Spain. Last week it was New Zealand. It's a big world. I might go everywhere, live on a train for a year or so.
See it all.
Just wish Kitty could be with me. That girl loved to travel.
We should get the money soon. I'll see you in a few days and divvy it up.
Chapter 16. I watched the press conference in my apartment. At some point in the last few hours, Mayor Woody has made the calculated decision that groveling might get him more votes than stonewalling. He stands behind a podium, and for the first time in recent history, there is no one behind him. Not a soul. He's all alone. No city councilman hamming it up for the cameras, no wall of thick-necked uniformed officers, no grim-faced lawyer frowning as if in hemorrhoidal agony. He explains to the small group of reporters that the city has settled its legal claims with the Renfro family. There will be no civil trial. The nightmare is over. Terms confidential, of course. His deepest apologies to the family for what happened. Mistakes were made, obviously, though none by him, and he has made the decision to act decisively and bring this tragedy to a close. The chief of police is fired, as of now. He is ultimately responsible for the actions of his officers. All 8 members of the SWAT team are also terminated. Their actions cannot be tolerated. Procedures will be reviewed, and so on. He wraps it up nicely with another apology, and at times looks and sounds as though he's ready to cry. Not a bad acting job for Woody, and it might even win him some votes. But any fool can read the polls. Gutsy move, Woody. Now, as if my life is not already complicated enough, there are 8 more ex-cops loose on the streets mumbling my name and looking for some type of revenge. The money arrives soon enough, and Doug and I do our business. The last time I see him, he's getting into a taxi headed for the airport. He said he's still not sure where he's going, but he'll figure it out when he gets there. He said he might stare at the departure board and throw a dart. I'm hit with a twinge of envy. Chapter 17. Taddeo insists that I stop by the jail for a visit at least once a week, and I really don't mind. Most visits include a conversation relating to his upcoming trial, and others that have nothing to do with anything but surviving in jail. There is no gym or place to exercise. He'll have those in prison, but we don't talk about this. And he is frustrated in his efforts to stay in shape. He's doing 1,000 sit-ups and push-ups each day, and looks fit to me. The food is terrible, and he says he's losing weight, which of course leads to a discussion about his preferred fighting weight once he gets out. The longer he stays in jail and the more free legal advice he gets from his cellmates back there, the more delusional he becomes. He's convinced he can charm a jury, blame it all on a quick bout of insanity, and walk. I explain, again, that the trial will be hard to win because the jury will see the video at least 5 times. He's also begun to doubt my belief in him, and on 2 occasions he's mentioned the involvement of another lawyer. This won't happen because he'll have to pay a fat fee to someone else, but it's still irritating. He's beginning to act like a lot of criminal defendants, especially those from the street. He doesn't trust the system, including me because I'm white and part of the power structure. He's convinced he's innocent and wrongly locked up. He knows he can sway a jury if given the chance, and I, as his lawyer, need only to work a few tricks in the courtroom and, just like on television, he'll be a free man. I don't argue with him, but I do try and keep things realistic. After 30 minutes, I say goodbye and am relieved to be away from him. As I work my way through the jail, Detective Reardon appears out of nowhere and almost bumps into me.
Say, Rudd, just the man I'm looking for.
I've never seen him at the jail before. This encounter is not accidental.
Oh, yeah? What's up? Got a minute?
He says, pointing to a corner away from the other lawyers and jailers.
Sure.
I don't really want to spend time with Reardon, but he's here for a purpose. I'm sure he wants to drive home the point that our suspended assistant chief of police, Roy Kemp, continues to be deeply concerned about keeping the kidnapping just between us boys. When we're alone, he says,
Say, Rudd, I hear you got in a scrape with a couple of Link Scanlon's thugs in the courthouse last week. Witnesses say you poleaxed both of them. Knocked them cold. Too bad you didn't put a bullet between their eyes. Wish I could have seen it. Hard to believe you got the balls to slug it out with a couple of leg breakers.
Your point?
I figure Link sent word to you that he wants something, probably money. We know about where he is. We just can't get to him. We think he's broke, and so he sends a couple of goons to put the squeeze on you. For some reason, you don't want to be squeezed. They push, you cold-cock them in broad daylight outside a courtroom.
I like it.
Your point? Do you know these two guys? I mean their names.
Something tells me to play dumb. One is called Tubby, no last name. Don't know the other. Got time for a question?
Oh, sure.
Your homicide. Why exactly?